everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Box Podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host, sorceress and child of Antares, Mikala Anne. On this week's episode, we have guest Mahegan of Kitchen Toad, here to discuss a variety of things revolving around animism and sorceress techniques used to help with spirit communication and relationships. Come join us as we discuss the various applications of the DCIS, how to use one's natal chart to find spirits that have a birthright relationship to us, and just enjoy the chaos-driven passion of listening to two Sagittarius with Gemini risings talk about their favorite things. This episode flies in like an Eight of Wands extraordinaire, ready to impart its listeners with inspiration and ideas on the deeply interwoven tapestry of the earth, the spirits contained above and below, and the way we live our lives with the knowledge of our ancestors and with a sorceress touch. If you find this podcast interesting and want to show some support, consider checking out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/Saturnbox. I can also be found on Facebook and Instagram at Saturnbox.
Hi, I'm Mahegan. I'm the curator and witch behind Kitchen Toad. So I mainly focus on plant-based animism as well as animism as a means to exist in the world by interacting with your local spiritual environment and ecology.
I love that. So just so that we can establish a foundation here, would you mind just giving our listeners a definition of what animism means to you?
Yeah. So animism to me is not necessarily the belief, but the recognition that there is spirit or consciousness in everything in life. And to me, that extends to non-natural objects as well. There's kind of a lot of debate in animism, whether things can take on spirit or if spirit is transferable. But as a witch, I find that the best way to understand it is that physical materiality is a vase to be filled. And so you find a lot of beliefs in, you know, animal spirits and stone spirits and spirits of place. You find spirits in the stars, in the zodiacs, the decans even. Like, you can break it down, really, to anything. And I personally adhere to that philosophy because it just makes sense to recognize the life of everything around you.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, that raises a really good point. I know that you spoke to me just casually about putting spirits in a crystal, but it occurred to me when you were talking just now that there might be some contradiction there in that if I already believe that the stone has a spirit, what's happening when I put another spirit into the stone? Do they cohabitate? Or is it more like you said, the stone's energy acts like a vase with which the other spirit can be contained within?
That's a really good question. How would I put that? I think that the best way is to like switch the metaphor into one of lenses.
Okay.
I think that when you bring in a spirit into a stone, you're going to have a certain filter over it depending on the qualities of that stone. For example, I recently made a Venus and Capricorn talisman and I did like see a spirit into it. But the stone I selected was one that I gathered myself. And it's either a jade or like a low grade agate. Like, I'm not very good at my mineralogy, But I chose it because the qualities of that stone are going to support my goals in the end. So you can kind of play around with different mediums for different spirits. And then kind of when you get into materia interaction and alchemy and the fusion of different spirits together, depending on the role and the context within which you interact with them as well.
Yeah, I love that. It actually made me think about the art card in Crowley's tarot. Just the idea of, you know, pouring the essence of the stone with the essence of whatever you're calling in and actually birthing a whole new thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, love that. Okay, cool. So is there something specific about animism that called you in that direction? You know, like, for example, there's a similar concept to what you were talking about in terms of everything having a spirit in, say, Kabbalah or Christian mysticism. Like, everything has an angel, every hour, every day, every action, and they're all just reflections of the cosmic deity. So what about animism made you decide, no, these other ones are maybe important but lesser to this idea of animism as a whole?
So that's actually really interesting because I've never really put much thought to it. I was raised by like a pagan mother who also was a reconstructionist archaeologist specializing in indigenous everything. So I kind of grew up performing a lot of like indigenous ceremonies of like the Algonquin people, specifically like Inunaskipi, which is who we're descended from. And so it was a belief that was kind of instilled in me from birth. I grew up saluting trees and like thanking stones for paving our way and stuff like that. To me, I think that belief stuck with me because whereas in like the Kabbalistic interpretation of the world, everything's a reflection of like a bigger cosmos or a bigger like logos, spirit, etc. Whereas animism is kind of like the absolute opposite of that, where we're talking about individuality of existence.
Yeah, I've never thought about it that way. I love that idea. Like, instead of everything almost being enslaved to the design of something else, it's as if we all function interdependently through the lens of animism.
Interdependently is a really good way to put it, yeah. I think that each of us is like a node in a very, very complex weaving. But it doesn't necessarily have to be like the, because you, you're thinking of weaving, you're thinking of like strands overlapping one another. But if you get into making tapestries, you can like see that it's knots and it's cutting string here and putting it there. And everything is so connected in a much more complex way than we understand.
Yeah, I love that perspective. That's also so interesting. It almost seems like it's also an ancestral calling. It's something that you feel connected to because of your mother, but also because of your lineage. And there's a sense of power in that as well.
Absolutely.
So I know through your Instagram, I see you talking a lot about, I used an election or I did it on this day and time. So in what ways, I guess in some ways you answered this because you were saying that the stars have spirits just as much as the trees and the stones, but in what ways does astrological magic tie into your work?
Yeah, well, if Earth were an ocean, the stars would be reflected in it. And I think that electional magic is kind of about figuring out what reflection you're capturing when you're creating something. So to me, bringing astrology and timing into my craft is like paramount. Working with the tides of the seasons, even not just like astrologically, but just as like what's happening around me, and then tying that to celestial phenomenon, because it's very as above, so below, but you can find such layers of meaning and understanding and depth to the comparison of what's happening on Earth versus what's happening in the skies. Like, I remember recently during the harvest season, the star Spica was rising, and she is like the spike in the hand of the Virgin. sometimes depicted as Demeter, sometimes as Persephone. It's kind of like who you're asking. But like that morning I looked and I was like, oh, great. Like, I've got to go do something. And I went outside and the fields were just like golden, like pure gold. And it's like capturing the moment of that. It's capturing the experience of your existence in a metaphorical yet tangible way, because the light that we're interacting with is literally in our reality. And focusing that allows us to shift its matter, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, definitely. It's interesting because hearing you talk about it in that way, I am like, oh, okay, so it isn't just vibrational energies that I'm trapping. It's like essence of spirit, essence of that star, essence of this moment. So maybe not, you know, maybe you can't, or maybe you can, just with a very in-depth working, call down the actual spirit of the star. It's more like that star bequeathing you part of its light.
Mm. You know, that kind of brings us back to that idea of filling a stone with a spirit. Because a lot of the time you're going to see, like, those kinds of spells or rituals in, like, early modern grimoires, talking about, like, drawing a planetary angel into a crystal or etc. And I do think that you can directly interact with the spirits in the stars. Like, I was talking with a friend about this, actually, this morning, about how my methodology kind of involves literally like reflecting the influence of a certain star through the moon and then bringing that reflection of the moon into a vessel of water that is then used as a means to communicate with that spirit, because we're literally creating a bridge where that spirit's presence can reflect into our own world. So in a way, they're kind of like stuck in the air, like they're stuck in the stars, but there's means for us to access them from our vantage point, you know?
Yeah, I love that. You create a mirror bridge, basically. Mm-hmm. And I like that, that you brought that up, because, you know, you hear that phrase drawing down the moon a lot. Mm-hmm. And that was what I thought of when you were saying that this is how you might create a bridge, like a mirror bridge through the light of the moon and into the water and then into my life. That's like drawing down the moon. We're not literally bringing it closer to us. We're drawing down its power through a reflective method, taking that light and kind of implanting it in something else.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yes, love that. Okay, since we're on the topic of this, I would like to hear more about the method of crystal placements that you've been talking to me about and mentioning on Instagram, the DSIC method.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's drawing spirits into crystals. It is a technique outlined by Trithemius of Spanheim in the Celestial Intelligencer / the Magus. It's basically a method of creating a table of practice like you kind of would with lots of different evocation methods, and then scrying a spirit's presence within this like central crystal. And that's done through like invocations and just, you know, different ritual tools, etc. And it's a very, very simple methodology that can really be adapted and applied to everything. You can make talismans, you can make yourself charm bags, you can get a spirit to like rest themselves into a powder. Like, I've even gone so far as completely ditching the crystal and just drawing the spirit into something. Yeah, and it's so adaptable. It's really, really amazing, like the experiences you can have with it. The crystal that we refer to in DSIC is like a quartz crystal. It's supposed to be a quartz ball the size of a small orange, actually.
Oh, so it's always quartz.
Yeah, so it is referred to as a quartz crystal. I've used obsidian with greater results just because I prefer like a black scrying surface. But the truth is, if you're going to follow the actual like instructions in that like Trithemius of Spanheim like lined out, you're going to be making a wand out of ebony. You're going to be like casting that orb, like that crystal, into like gold, or setting it in a disc of gold, depending who you're asking, or a monstrance as well. and there's like a bunch of tools. I am kind of like a down and dirty witch kind of magician, so I don't necessarily follow everything by the book. And I've kind of experienced different results with different things. Like, I personally prefer drawing the spirit into the crystal, as in like scrying it through that little like ball and then asking it to enter a different item, and then it will transfer over. And you can kind of see that methodology in the Grimoire of Arthur Gauntlet, as well as the Book of Oberon, I believe, has something similar. But otherwise, I would use different crystals for like maybe different planetary rulers. I imagine like a really shiny piece of lapis would be wonderful for Jupiter. I'm sure he would love that. You know, using a carnelian for the sun, or even like in the quartz family, since you have pretty much any shade of quartz you want, you can probably just tune them to whichever planetary ruler you like.
Yeah, that's, I would not have assumed that it was just quartz when you first brought it up. I would have assumed that I would, you know, look in my reference books of William Lilly or Agrippa and say which stone responds to this intelligence, and I would have used that. But it actually, just based off of what quartz does and how quartz works as a crystal, it's literally in our computers because it's so good at conducting energy. It would make sense for quartz to work. And obsidian too, because obsidian has that same quality of channeling beyond, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into like the nitty-gritty of it, we can think of quartz and obsidian and all those like naturally formed stones as like living glass, which in turn means that it is like a solidified liquid, or rather like a very, very, very slow flowing liquid. And that's kind of interesting, because usually like you're doing water scrying or reflection scrying, which, you know, kind of stemmed from that, or even oil, but you're kind of always using like a fluid medium. Sometimes you're using your fingernail, but we're gonna ignore that for the sake of this point.
That doesn't fit my theory, so it can ponder orbs elsewhere.
Exactly. Ponder another orb. But, you know, like the importance of the fluidity of the medium, I think, is very pronounced. Like, I've tried using glass, or even I've used a like an artificial obsidian that was grown in a lab, and like the crystal structure of those is going to be a lot more like streamlined. It's just gonna be very like clean and like won't have any mistakes done, whereas like a natural piece of quartz, you will find those irregularities. But like the living, the fluid aspect of it is kind of what we're using to be able to contain that spirit in the moment, you know? Like, it's not just like a hunk of rock when you like have drawn something into it. In the same way that you can draw a spirit into a glass of water, yeah, and drink it, you know? You're playing off of like the capacity for holding personality almost, or like persona or consciousness, whatever you want to call it. And then we can get into all the water consciousness and words being spoken over them and all that, but you know.
Yeah, actually, that was my next question, is what do you personally think makes the state of something being liquid, the closeness to the element of water, in what way does that facilitate channeling and facilitate spirit contact, in your opinion?
To get like a little bit into my cosmology, like I believe that there's like a land serpent that flows in and out of the earth. I also believe that there's a moon serpent that does like a similar thing. But I also believe that there's like an Ouroboros like around our cosmos, and that's actually like a river. And then you've also got like the association of, you know, like the rivers of the dead, or like crossing the thin or the veil, or the river to the other side. And you have kind of all these historical and folkloric references to water being a portal into another world. You get into, you know, the like the Gaelic belief of bogs being entrances to the underworld because of the reflection of the sky. Mm-hmm. You know, water to me is kind of like the medium through which we're animated. It's the medium through which we gain the ability of choice, fluidity, elasticity, the power to like change and mutate and evolve, are kind of all things associated with like elemental water, like not literally, obviously. And, you know, you can even argue that, like, the, like, very, like, make of your being is kind of just, like, one piece of the river of DNA that runs through your veins, you know? I think that water has always been the precursor to life. It's been, like, the primordial ocean. The elements that make up water are some of the simplest ones, and yet we need them for literally everything. And to me, it's kind of like an innate understanding of water, I guess, as the medium through which we can experience life, both physical, non-corporeal, supernatural, philosophical, etc. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that answer. Because there, you know, water is actually what we birthed out of. It's where we, and not, I don't just mean that, you know, genetically, like we evolved from water microbes, which is true, but also when in the gestating period within the womb. That's all water.
Yes.
And there is just something so, so nurturing about water, as well as I loved your point about the bogs in Gaelic mythology and how the water would reflect the sky, because that kind of goes back to what you were talking about with drawing down the moon through using a mirror and then a vessel of water. That water can both, it seems, contain and reflect without losing what it contains. It will reflect.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. Water is kind of like everything at once, right? You know, you can have it sub-freezing temperatures and still be liquid, depending on like air, like pressure or, you know, anything like that. And I really do think that water's ability to retain, like, existence in a metaphorical way is what allows us to use scrying mediums and things like, what are they called? Fluid condenser. There it is. Oh my god. Yeah, and that's kind of, like, where we can use fluid condensers and other means, like, aqueous means of delivering magic, because water naturally holds on to that spirit and to that charge. By virtue of its existence, it can reflect other virtues, it can hold them within itself as the universal solvent, you know?
Fluid conductor. God, I love this. Okay, new question. What you were just talking about, it made me think about copper. From fluid conductor to copper, because copper is associated with Venus, who is associated with water, even though copper itself, I mean, I'm not a geologist or even a chemist or a scientist even. So I don't exactly know, you know, if there are similarities between copper and a liquid. I know you can melt it into a liquid, but usually it's a solid. But I don't know, like, I just feel like there's something here. There's a thread here.
Yeah, I think that has to do with Venus's action as the great interconnector. You know, Venus's union. And we're talking about copper, which is like the most conductive metal. It conducts heat, it conducts, like other than silver and gold, it conducts electricity, cold, everything. Copper will kind of take on whatever quality it's placed nearby, which is kind of like water when you're, you know, like, you know, we're talking about moon water, like water naturally captures pneuma, you know? And I think that copper does the same thing where it like gathers pneuma, but it doesn't hold it in like stasis by movement. Like, I'm thinking of the figure populus right now when I'm thinking of like stasis and movement, because it's very much like a lake is still in theory, like if you look at it, but there's always like stuff moving, and water is kind of like that, where it will stay in its form but be constantly shifting, whereas copper moves in a linear motion. So I think that copper's connection to something else allows it to transfer ideas and transfer pneuma, whereas water, being the universal solvent and being connected to everything at all times, is in constant state of flux and stasis, therefore allowing it to hold as well as be, like, generative, you know?
Yes, I love this. So in the way that I kind of hypothesized that water worked as both a container and a reflector simultaneously, the copper would just merely kind of contain and move from point A to point B. In the same way that if I go and get a piece of natural obsidian, and there might be some traces of other things in there, which is what water would be. Then we have the synthetic obsidian that's just purely conducting in the way that copper would just conduct from point A to point B cleanly.
Yeah, that's a really good link. Because I find that, like, things, for example, glass, like, things that are man-made tend to either completely block or hold onto and release very quickly. And obviously, like, because we're talking about the flux of copper and, like, linear motion and stuff like that, but copper is used in a lot of, like, talismanic uses, in which cases it does hold onto, like, a virtue. I'm not saying that copper just, like, shoots energy out.
Well, if you shape it in a circle, it's just recycling the energy back into itself.
Now, hold on. Yeah, I was actually looking into, you know, those little, like, pyramids that have all, like, the weird stuff in them, like, orgon pyramids or whatever? They're, like, resin pyramids filled with conductive metals and, like, crystals and other little things like that. And they're supposed to generate energy. But I actually fell down this rabbit hole on, like, an alchemy forum that was, like, unlisted in, like, 2008. So I couldn't tell you where it is anymore. But they were basically theorizing about creating organ projectors by using copper tubing. Because specifically of that circular motion of energy being able to flow kind of, like, in a spiral down the tube and then be projected through, like, an orifice. And it was just, like, super interesting. Sorry, I'm, like, getting into all the theories.
Really cool to me, actually. I'm still waiting for the day that we start using stem cells to 3D print food, man. That's like...
Oh my god, like Spy Kids.
Yeah, because then I wouldn't have to worry about, you know, the soul of whatever I'm consuming.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so similar vein, new question. We were kind of talking on DMs recently about, well, me being vegan and you kind of transitioning back into being vegetarian for Hecate reasons. And this, the idea in the Hecate cult is to be vegetarian is to be pure, as in I'm not intaking something else's spirit. That kind of implies, though, this idea that when I eat another living thing, I consume its power, which, shout out to Anne Rice, RIP, her book Queen of the Damned was the first time that I ever was presented to the idea that if you consume something, you gain its power. You know, we're going kind of off there, but if we 3D print food, would it have a soul? Would it be a part of this network of animism in which when I consume it, I obtain the power of that animal?
That's a really interesting thought. The first thing that kind of jumps to mind is, like, consumption of psychedelics or hallucinogens, especially entheogens. Because if we're talking, like, mugwort, for example, that does have, like, sajone and has different alkaloids in it that aren't actually, like, psychotropic in any way, according to science. You know, you're taking mugwort, but you're still experiencing, like, an altered state of consciousness. And to me, the reason for that is because of the holistic interaction between you and its spirit during consumption. The same kind of idea with berserkers using Amanita, or what we call berserkers, but, you know, Amanita as, like, bear medicine to go into a rage in battle and take on the virtues of this, like, very, very strong, very powerful animal who was seen eating those mushrooms. And they, like, associated it. From what I've heard, I don't have any, like, sources on this.
Oh, so this isn't a firsthand experience account.
No. Like, I didn't read about this in a book. Like, this is something I've seen in conversation. But the idea of, like, consuming something that, like, the bear would consume to then go into a similar, like, thrashing or rage.
Yes.
Or if you're looking at, like, humoral medicine in early modern history, which, thanks to Al Cummins, The Devil's Bath, beautiful, beautiful lecture on the four humors. And in it, he talks about different, like, medical applications of, for example, wolf's blood, which is seen as being an incredibly sanguine and martial and airy constituent, being not only the literal blood of a wolf, but also being of an animal that was associated with Mars and was considered very sanguine, and using that blood to forever, for example, heal a very melancholic constitution, you know? So the blood itself isn't having any effect, but we're talking about the pneuma or the humor or the energy or whatever you want to call it carried within its blood affecting our spirit, you know? So it's similar to shapeshifting, for example, where you kind of like adorn yourself with things of that animal. You might even consume part of its flesh. You might, you know, I've seen shapeshifting charms that involve like crushing like dried gallbladder and eating it, or the toad bone ritual where you literally basically you crucify a toad on an anthill, and then you select a special bone by throwing it into a river, you fend off the devil for 3 nights, sometimes 9 nights, depending on how scary he's feeling. First you'll make an amulet, and then you'll do it a second time and powder the bone and eat it, and then that literally seats the spirit of a toad within yourself and gets you access to toad magic and like sorcery. You know, the interconnection of animal or plant spirit, or even mineral spirit, if you want to get into like gem elixirs and stuff like that, which I know nothing about, and ours is one that can be seen even with like flower essences, where there's no medicinal component, but there's a holistic effect by acting on the auric body. Like, there's all these instances where another spirit will kind of come into your own physicality and affect things on, like, a subtle scale that you might not be able to see. And I think it's the same thing with magic. With the toad bone, like, I kind of see it in the way that the ants pick apart the toad as spirits pick you apart so that you can be reborn into the witch. Kind of that idea of being taken down into, like, the tonic realms. And processed into the like mycelium of the world, you know? And I think that like following procedure isn't necessarily important. I think that the symbolism and like the mythic element of procedure as outlined in like a lot of grimoires, because, you know, we like went through a good like 600-700 years of people just writing very like by the book, like, if you don't do this, you're gonna die, which isn't the case. I mean, like, most of the time things are gonna flop. If you're dealing with spirits, then it gets a little complicated. But the most important part of following any ritual is to invoke the key elements and find the right like font of power to achieve what you want. So with DSIC, like drawing spirits into crystals, you're calling on like the one true god, like Tetragrammaton and Adonai, etc., etc. And I think that if you weren't to use those names, then you wouldn't achieve the results that you want. It doesn't mean that you can't draw spirits into crystal without, like, with another methodology. But if I were to, for example, to swap out all of the names in, like, an invocation prayer with, like, epithets of Hecate, like, it's not going to work. Because I'm calling certain spirits by authorities they don't listen to.
Yeah, well, and Hecate is also not an example of, like, a cosmic deity in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So then what would your opinion be, for example, on things like Crowley's rewriting of the headless, his boneless, right?
I am going to be honest with you. I read like maybe 3 or 4 pages of one Crowley book when I was like 14, and I put it down and never touched it again. I understand like the psychological model of magic that he was trying to pursue and what he was trying to achieve through it. And I understand that his version of the headless rite is like a representation of the goals that he was trying to attain.
Yeah, because in the original, the cosmic deity is Yahuwah, you know, and you put on the godhead of Moses, so it's very kind of Jewish. Then Crowley just changed that to be his Egyptian pantheon. So you're like, but, yeah. You know, Osranophris was in the original as well. So,
that's true.
Are they not both just different names for a cosmic deity? Are they two different egregores of representation of a cosmic deity?
I love this question. I am such a hard polytheist when it comes to that. I believe that spirit is spirit, and they're all different. Like, to me, swapping out like names in an invocation or like in a conjuration, or even like what Crowley did with like the headless rite, where he completely like switched the whole thing around. Actually, I was talking with friends recently, because Roger J. Horn, Bless that man. He has amazing works. But he wrote The Witch's Art of Incantation. And I have a problem with that book because all of it is like rearranged or abridged from the Carmina Gadelica or from like Orphic Hymns or other stuff like that. And to me, that is like the highest disrespect you can make, because we learn that word is contract and that word is creation. And then if we like fuck with them, can I swear?
Yeah.
Okay. like change the words around. It's basically like if I were to call, like walk into my boss's like office one day and be like, her name is Sharon, let's say, and call her like Leela. You know, how's that going to go for me? Not great. Yeah, no. Higher ups do not want to see Leela's signature on anything. And Leela doesn't have authority to boss around the employees. So that's kind of how I see it. I'm what I would kind of call a, back in high school, I used to call it a positive nihilist. I haven't quite made up my mind on any like philosophy or cosmology of life, but I personally do ascribe to the idea of a demiurge, which is so weird and out of left field in general. God is dead or whatever. And that the emanation that like came down to build our world did create kind of like an incomplete space. But then we get to fill it with all these beautiful things that we create, you know?
Okay, so then because the deity or the creatrix left openings, then that's what we fill with our creative spark.
Yeah, with like society and culture and language and art and passion and all those things. Because like, if you really want to get into it, like all those pleasurable, beautiful things that we enjoy as hedonism, or the other side of the coin of it, everything that we create as human beings is beautiful, like in terms of art and architecture and all those things, you know, like us as like a humanity, what we've done is beautiful and we've achieved like so many things, but none of it has ever come from beauty. You know, we create beauty from struggle, we create beauty from boredom, from emptiness. We create beauty from need or from necessity. And I feel like that's kind of all these like things that we create are born out of, I don't want to say like ugliness, but like our like status, our role, I think, like in the spiritual ecology is kind of to be able to transmute these bad things into beauty and fill the void that was left by an incomplete creation.
Yeah, I love that perspective because it is kind of, I don't know, it reminds me exactly of putting a spirit in a stone, putting a spirit in a crystal, because it's like the earth itself is one big stone, and then we are filling it with our essence.
I love that. But yeah, because that even works with like the idea of like beauty and like pushing it to its extreme of, I don't even know if I'm using the word hedonism right. I think I am.
I think so.
Yeah.
Grammar is a social construct.
Exactly. Yeah, words don't mean anything. I don't speak English, so.
Yeah, you speak French.
Exactly. But yeah, I think that what we're seeing now is kind of like we've pushed our society, we've pushed our civilization so far. We've made such great advancements, and yet we're worse for it. Like, the earth around us is dying. We're using our resources wrong. We're wasting everything. And, you know, it is kind of like pouring our spirit into the earth, but at this point, the earth is cracking. A spirit can be, like, overbearing. I've had, like, crystals, like, in rings, for example, like, break during consecrations. Like, there are certain things that can't hold spirit due to magnitude. Like, I wouldn't try to seed a god into a crystal. You know, that's not going to work. But I think that what we can compare that to is kind of like our presence on earth has become so heavy and so strong that our spirit is now cracking the stone, you know,
like the vessel is breaking and we're just pouring out into the void.
Exactly. And the vessel is going to keep it like existing, you know, in shards and differently, and with its scars, but we will dissipate fully, you know. And that's kind of where I'm at with like nihilism, because I don't have like the proof to believe that there is any sort of afterlife. Like, I believe that our spirit kind of splits into like multiple parts, but my consciousness and who I am as like a crystalline ego right now isn't ever going to exist after my death. Personally, I would love if I could join the mighty dead. That would be really great. Or maybe I'll keep traveling, or maybe my breath will enter into like a newborn child. I don't know. And because of that, I kind of have difficulty ascribing any sort of like real tangible purpose to our existence other than being able to create and like fill by positivity the void, which is the negative. You know what I mean? Like of like the magnets. Our role on Earth is kind of to balance out that negative void that was left by filling it with a positive current. Yeah, polarities, binaries.
Yeah, I love this. This idea that the only purpose that we truly have is to create. I feel like that is what the Bible meant when the Bible said he created us in his, you know, they, because it's really Elohim, so the plural entity created us in its image.
Mm-hmm.
Creator.
Exactly.
Like, what is it but a creator? So if we are made in its image, that means we are creators. That is our purpose. It doesn't matter if we die as a species 6 months from now. The only thing that matters is that at each day that we are alive, we choose to create.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I do think that that is positive work, even if the thing that you're creating is not positive. Just because I think that on a non-human level, good and bad isn't the same as what it is on the human level.
Absolutely. Yeah. Completely agree.
Yay. We are like going way more into metaphysics and theology than I expected.
Oh, really?
Yes, it's beautiful.
Yeah, I don't really talk about any of this stuff otherwise. Like, it's all my thoughts, so that's kind of why I'm all, like, jumbled, because I usually don't try to discuss, like, the meaning of life and such things, because to be honest, like, the conversation does get very boring if you're talking to people who, like, don't make this their, like, occupation. You know what I mean? So this is so fun.
Secretly, that was definitely one of my personal perks when I decided to start the podcast, was like, oh, I just need people that will talk to me about these things.
Yeah, right?
Yes. Oh, I love that. Okay, so what then would you say, just, we're kind of changing veins here a little bit, but what is the process that you go through when you're meeting and developing relationships with new spirits, whether it be plant or a fixed star or a land?
Mm-hmm.
Is it different for different types?
Definitely, yeah. Personally, like, I'm just going to start at land because that's kind of mostly what I do. To me, it's important to visit a space or a place in each of the seasons, as well as in each of the different weathers. Like, I would definitely visit a place when it's raining, as well as when it's sunny, when it's cloudy, when it's misty, etc., to get an impression of the spirit through material means only first. And to me, like, familiarity with a place is very, very important to building a relationship. Because, like, in my youth, and I am still young, but in my youther, I often, like, went to places and just, like, left offerings and, you know, just, like, got real into it real fast and then like spend time collecting a mutual understanding with the place. And then that led to like angry spirits and parasitic stuff and et cetera, especially when your like psychic muscle isn't super trained, which mine is like severely debilitated. It can get pretty tricky. So I do try to like spend a lot of time there at first. And then I will slowly, maybe I'll smoke a few cigarettes there and like dump half the tobacco on the ground. And I'll just like start doing like small things to like honor the place first before I make any actual like offerings. Because to me, offerings aren't just like, I give you this. Offerings are like, we are sitting down and having a meal.
I've invited you to my table.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm laying out a table for you. I'm inviting you to come and partake of this and commune with me, you know, the same way that you get coffee with a friend. So to me, it's important to kind of build up that familiarity so that you're not like a stranger to like the place that you're visiting and to the spirits there. With fixed stars, you don't really need to build a relationship with them because you can kind of just work off of their, like, I don't want to say mechanical nature, but, like, when we're talking about astrology, like, there is a sense of this, like, giant cosmic clock. And so you can tune into those spirits at like auspicious times and then get them to work for you by just like propitiating.
See, I have dyslexia, so when I read words like that, I just, you know, it's a letters. It's just letters.
I have no clue. but you can kind of just petition the spirit and, you know, get on with it. But when you want to build a relationship, I have a pretty close working relationship with Speak Out and Aldebaran.
So do you know then if they are prominent in your birth chart? Does like that matter to you, or is it?
Ooh, I can get into that. For sure. So with them, like, I have done a lot of trance work and lots of, like, meditation to connect with them, specifically through talismans that I crafted. And again, like, I crafted those talismans by drawing the spirit of the star into a vessel of water and then getting them to enter a talisman. And so those things kind of serve as, like, key points to access them. Another way that you can get to know fixed star spirits is, like, through your birth chart, of course. If you have any conjunctions with fixed stars in your chart, it's a very good idea to kind of like plot your magical curriculum around them, because those are fonts of powers that are like innately given to you. For example, like we have our sun on Antares, and so we're very, very like strong personalities. We're loud, we're boisterous, we're honorable. Our pride is very important to us. But not only that, but we also gain access to Antares as the commander, as the leader of legions, as the one who rallies and then thrashes, you know? So we can be pulling on him for drive, even like within ourselves, like theurgically, or we can literally like sick him on other people because we have favor from birth. Another star that is very like special to me is Alcyone, which is the star of the Pleiades, because it's directly on my ascendant. And you know, that has really like affected my perception of magic more and more as I'm finding out, as I'm like delving into her and into my chart. But the fixed stars will kind of give not quite a lens to your planets, but like a supporting power. So for example, I have a friend with Jupiter on Denebalgeti. With like Denebalgeti and Jupiter, you're going to get Jupiter's regular like functions as a planet, but you're also going to get that like very, very strong, like righteous Saturnian, like law and court energy that's going to manifest through Jupiter. And then like, especially let's say your Jupiter is retrograde like mine is, your tendencies for expansion are going to be inwards. And so like someone who has that placement would probably be like constantly judging themselves and constantly like basing their morality and ethics on like an objective court that they hold within themselves because of Denebalgeti's influence as like a lawmaker, you know? But that also means that within the context of magic, if they want to do some like court magic, if they want to like, you know, spit some galangal on the ground, Denebalgeti's force is going to be with them through their blood, even, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say they'd probably have good luck with the law.
Exactly. Yeah. Like get away from cops, like all of that stuff. Because when we're looking at the fixed stars, we're looking at the anchors that hold our cosmos in place. So when they appear in the chart, it's kind of like saying you have like an immediate in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So for like anyone who wants to develop a working relationship with the stars of their chart, or even any star, really, personally, I find that if you work with something that's appearing in your chart, you don't necessarily need like the strongest election for it. When the star is rising is fine. When it's above the horizon, or you know, when the moon is conjunct the star, or like applying a sextile or a trine aspect conjunction, all the better, you know? And then you kind of want to like enter an altered state of consciousness that doesn't necessarily need to be like crazy trance, but you definitely want to be like receptive. And then I would like say recite the hymn to Astron, like the Orphic hymn to the stars, swap out the names, especially if like you work with the mansions, there's like spirit names that you can kind of fit within the mansions, and you can call on that if the moon is conjunct the star. Stars don't really care for like physical offerings, I find. They really like incense, they like perfumes, they like vapors, they like scents and things that rise up into the heavens. So like candles and all that kind of stuff, you can offer. I make like an Alcyone perfume for myself, which is in and of itself like an offering to the star, like the actual act of preparing it and like making it. And I'll like prepare it talismanically by like putting all my fragrances together and then doing a gestation period during a moon cycle and all that fun, funky, crazy stuff. But really building a relationship with them is kind of just like returning home to a distant relative. You don't have to be fancy. You don't have to be crazy about it. In my experience, you'll find like a beam kind of just like hits you out of the blue one day. Like it doesn't necessarily happen during like the like offering ritual or the communion or whatever, because I think they're a little bit removed from us, unless you draw them down, obviously, but they kind of have like a 2 to 5 day business day notice kind of thing going. Yeah, working with Alkyone has like brought me like insights that were like life shattering, for example, that kind of just like dawned on me out of nowhere.
So were your insights with Alkyone directly related to your persona, your body, like first house issues?
Yeah, I mean, it was a complete like cosmology shift. It completely like changed the way that I understand God and divinity and like the weaving and the tapestry of life and everything. Like, I swear, dude, it was like someone hit me with a ton of bricks. And I just understood my place in the universe and like understood like where I stand is like where a grain of sand is on a beach. You know, it doesn't matter whatsoever. And Alkyone is associated with the eyes and stuff like that. And, you know, just brings a lot of clarity. I don't know exactly how things play out with houses and fixed stars, to be quite honest. I'm quite new to the houses and what they do outside of geomancy. So I have like a good idea, but things change a little bit. So I don't want to say anything crazy on that.
I was wondering, going back to what you were saying about the fixed stars and you saying you have a relationship with them from birth, if it is displayed in the birth chart. And you brought up our relationship. For those who are listening, Mahigan and I share the same birthday. Yes, that's right. I have both my birthday twins on the podcast now. A+.
Oh, yeah.
So Antares is associated with Archangel Uriel. Or for example, how you said Spica is sometimes associated with Demeter, sometimes Persephone. So when you are working with them, do you think about them just as like Spica and just as Antares? Or are you personifying them even further by saying, or I have a relationship with Spica, so I also have a relationship with Demeter. Or I have a relationship with Antares, and therefore Uriel is, you know, very present in my life.
I would say that it kind of depends to what like level of scrutiny you break it down to, because I work, for example, I work with the fixed stars very similarly to how I work with planetary powers. So, for example, Jupiter, I honor both Tzadkiel and Jove, but I'm fully aware that my relationship is with the planet. So you can view the fixed stars or the planets or whatever as like houses containing a multitude of spirits, depending on what systems you're talking about or depending on what mythology you want to follow. But spirits that will share a common interest and a common kind of primordial like existence. So under Spica, or even, what's a good example? Because I actually don't know too much about like the exact spirits that are associated with specific fixed stars. I know, for example, that Spica has a lot of fey lore, lots of stuff with like weeping mothers, like Rusalki. But each of them kind of contains a multitude. So you can work with the fixed star as the spirit of the house, in quotation mark, of Spica, and you can work specifically with the energies of that spirit, or then you can break it down into, oh, well, I follow like a Hellenistic practice, so I can call onto Demeter because she's the one who holds Spica, you know, and you'll find closeness to those spirits much more easily, in my experience anyways. It's kind of like if you have a familiar, you might have had a familiar for 5-6 years and you don't know it. And when you return to like a fixed star spirit, it kind of just dawns on you how present their existence was. You know, for example, like Antares, I have no relationship with Uriel whatsoever, but a spirit or a goddess that has always been with me, and no matter what, like ups and downs before I practiced, since I've practiced, while I was doing like goetic demon conjurations, like all of that was Bridget. Like she was always with me. And, you know, she kind of shares those. I would personally put her with Antares because of those incredibly, like, solar very, very, like, martial qualities of, like, the blacksmithing and the flame and the keeper of it and, like, all that stuff. And she's kind of a spirit that I've associated with that star, where I would consider her part of my spiritual court by virtue of existence, in the same way that, like, your head guardian angel or your metite or, you know, a spirit lover or a fetch is, like, literally within you and within your blood. Because really, when you're born, you're a talisman of those energies. And so, like, you're being born with these spirits inside of you, basically. If you want to look at it in, like, a very hard animistic way of, like, every, like, talisman is imbued with the spirit of, like, a specific, like, celestial body. When you're born, like, those powers are innate within you.
And because I'm made of water, it literally is trapped in me in that receptive way.
We're making links. Yes. We're connecting the web.
The tapestry is being created.
Exactly. I feel a little bit like that, like a conspiracy theorist right now, like bouncing from like point to point, but everything links up somewhere, I promise.
Love that. No, I agree with that. And I can't say, I personally have never worked with Brigitte, so I can't comment on her connection to Antares, but I can tell you that I'm going to blank on his name, and there's going to be somebody listening to this cast who's going to be like, it's blah, blah, blah. But the guy who made that duel, he made two decks and he sold them at once, and one was all 72 angels and one was all 72 Goetia.
I remember that, yeah.
And a friend bought that, and she only wanted the Goetia, so she gave me the angels. And I'm like, I consecrated it, and I did, you know, everything. And then I did my first reading with it was what three angels are most present for me.
Mm.
And it, you know, you would expect it, I guess, maybe some people, depending on their cosmology, would expect it to be the ones that, you know, Agrippa would say were my angels according to my birthday. That's not the ones that showed up. But Uriel was one of the three. And then when I found out later that Antares was related to Uriel, I was like, magic is real, tarot is true. Like,
I've kind of adopted this view recently that, like, the fixed stars in the chart are somewhat of, like, a cosmic inheritance. Amaya Feral Venefica on Twitter talks about the fixed stars all the time, and I find everything that she has to say is so fascinating. Thinking about the fixed stars as, like, a cosmic inheritance has really helped me place, like, how they behave in my chart, you know? For example, I personally perceive it this way, it might not be the case, but I feel like every time I reach, like, a point where I feel successful, I get burnt. And that's been, like, a reoccurring pattern in my life, and then I found out that my part of fortune is directly on Sirius.
Mm.
You know? Or I'm, like, laying myself out right now, but I am someone who does not get angry. Like, I have a Mars in Libra. My, like, go-to if something happens is to make nice and hopefully, like, a cake will fix it. But the only place I will get, like, genuinely upset is when people either don't recognize me or, like, don't give me, like, the recognition I think I deserve, or don't look at my efforts or hurt my pride or my honor, or those that I hold dear. And those are all things that the sun is, like, related to. And my sun is directly on Antares, who has to do with honor and with kingship in relation to dominion.
Yes, we talked about this because I definitely, that will set me off too. Those same things will set me off.
Yeah, and I find, I've actually been looking at multiple charts recently that everyone has on Mars in Libra. I don't know what's going on, but everyone I'm talking to right now has Mars in Libra. And I looked at their chart and everyone has, like, a weird fixed star placement that has to do with anger, that is literally the only place that they get angry, which I find super interesting, because we can see, like, the fixed stars as having an influence on the planets. Because my, like, for example, my Mars in Libra doesn't get activated very often, like, not in the astrology sense, but in the sense of, like, within my personality. But when it does get activated is when Antares gets activated. You know?
Yeah, the justice boner. Like, treat me with respect and treat others with respect. And if you don't...
Fairness.
Yeah. Accountability. People being able to hold themselves accountable for things. I will literally just cut people out. I don't even care anymore.
Absolutely. I will burn bridges before someone finishes their sentence.
Like, oh, you're not willing to hold yourself accountable. Okay, goodbye forever.
Yeah, literally. I also find that the fixed stars are very fatalistic. But, you know, like, even if you look in, like, Ptolemy and, like, Agrippa and stuff, you have, like, fixed star conjunctions that are like, you're going to die by getting decapitated. You know, like, for example, Algol is a star that I'm very, very into because she's on my Saturn by a degree, which is, like, it's an intense one.
Yeah.
But she's, like, super, super interesting. So Algol is a star that, like, has to do with the decapitation of the Gorgon. It's the blinking eye of the Gorgon. And so traditionally, like, you see associations with it that are like madness, delirium, dementia, beheadedness, muteness, blindness, etc. Same with Alcyone, you see blindness a lot. You see death by insanity a lot. And we have to understand that, like, that's within, like, a very specific, like, cultural context and, like, era, you know?
Oh my gosh, does this mean we're gonna die in battle?
Maybe. That's very possible.
I'm okay with a warrior's death.
Right? Yeah, rain of bullets. Holy. But I find that they tend to be very fatalistic in the chart. Like, their effects are incredibly pronounced, depending on what ruler activates them, like which planetary body. What's a good example that I could give? I would expect someone with, like, Spica and Mercury conjoined to literally be Monsanto. It's just riches and trade specifically, but, like, not necessarily insight. Like, Spica's a very, like, demure kind of presence. Like, she just vibes, you know, she's the fields. But with Mercury there, you're, like, bringing a transactional aspect. And then Spica's, like, associations with agriculture are just going to be, like, in your face, like, directly. Because they're very, very, very powerful, but they're also very, very precise actions. You'll see that a lot of the stars are compared to, like, two planets. For example, Spica is, like, the shaft of wheat, and so it's the Mars and Venus star is the only one. And the reason for that is because of its generative power. So Mars and Venus together generate, and thus Spica's, like, you know, actions can be described by them. But I find that whereas the planets will be, like, you know, Mars's drive and determination and blood and sanguineness and all those things, fixed stars stick to their own and are incredibly, like, nuanced in, like, their differentiation between each other. Does that make sense?
I think it did, yeah, because basically, the planets, and maybe this is, like, a partially because they move. So there's a transit to the way that their energy can express itself. They're malleable.
Really interesting, because Virgo now hosts Regulus, and she used to be Regulus used to be in Leo. And when that shift happened, I remember, because I was doing, like, a crap ton of research on Regulus when I was doing my Regulus oil and tincture last year,
which I love, by the way. I use it.
Yay, I'm so glad. Use it for the podcast.
I put it under my eyes before I do the recording. Yeah.
Really? Oh my god, I love that. That's perfect. But yeah, so when the switch happened from Leo to Virgo, so many astrologers were, like, going crazy. They're like, this is epic. These are, like, crazy proportions, because a star only shifts a degree every 70 years. Like, our pole star is going to be our pole star for another, like, 3,000 years. It used to be this other one. I don't remember the name. Like, 6,000 BCE, you know? And so that's, like, a really good point, because the planets are always, like, moving, and you can tell that, like, Saturn's influence shifts very slowly compared to Mercury's, which moves very rapidly. And so with the fixed stars, they're literally, like, not moving. And so maybe that is why they're so, like, singular and so, like, specific in their meaning.
Yeah, I love when the metaphor matches what you see in reality. That always excites me.
Mm-hmm. That kind of reminds me of, like, specific degrees within the zodiac that have, like, planetary rulers, like the 23rd of Scorpio being ruled by Mercury, you know?
Yeah, I don't know enough about all the deacons, and then there's also the deacons, and then there's the Egyptian terms, and they're both different, and they have different planetary rulers. So I'm just like, I know that those things exist, but I can't even really tell you what it means for something to be a bound lord. I know that it basically has to do with the way that the planet will... It's like the room of the house. So the domicile itself is the house. So, and mm-hmm. then there are different rooms in the house. So, like, for example, my Saturn is in a Venus Egyptian term. So my Saturn in Aquarius is in Saturn's house, but sitting in Venus's room.
Oh, I see. So your Saturn and Venus play better together, I guess.
Yeah, which is good, especially with the Venus Capricorn, because there's that Saturn-Venus interaction happening there as well.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I am also kind of just all over the place with astrology. Everything I know is learned from, like, magic experience or osmosis. So don't hold me to any, like, high standard.
Gemini ascendants over here, like, oh, I just picked a random advanced aspect of astrology and just went on a wormhole of that.
I just get so entranced and engrossed in these, like, very, like, niche, like, specific topics, especially in magic. Like, after, like, nearly 11 years of practice, it's just hard to get my attention anymore, you know? So I find that when I explore, like, new subjects, like, for example, astrology, like, I didn't even touch astrology with, like, a 10-foot stick 4 years ago, you know?
Yeah, I was the same way. It wasn't until I found out about Hellenistic astrology that I was like, oh, I'll give this a try.
Right? Yeah, I got into it actually because one of my pacts with, my pact with the Witch Father fell through. Perfectly a user error, but I didn't know, like, what to turn to. So I turned to astrology and specifically to the planets. That's when I got into my Solomonic stuff and my DSIC and Heptameron, all those things. But before then, honestly, no clue. So everything I know is from experience, practical magic, elections and weird little conjure books, or like osmosis from like my amazing astrologer friends. So I'm not like an authority on anything.
Bless our amazing astrologer friends who answer our random questions that we send every day.
Absolutely. Bless them. Oh my goodness.
The actual heroes of this podcast.
Genuinely, I think that if we made astrologers like cool again and like had one in every neighborhood that like consulted with everyone, this earth would be so green, y'all. Like, it would be so nice. Peace, love, beauty. Like, nothing else.
I love astrology. I love that idea. So let's move on to our last question. And this one's just fun. But do you have a favorite plant? And can you tell us a little bit about your favorite plant spirit?
Yeah, definitely henbane for me. I haven't worked with henbane in like 2 years, I think. And it's been like sorely missing. It's one of the only poisons that is associated with Jupiter, which I find very, very interesting because most poisons are going to be under Venus or the Moon or Saturn. Saturn is like the big one that everyone knows of. Venom kind of falls under Mars, right? I say Venus because you have things like foxglove that fall under like fairy things that are poisonous. But henbane is one of the very rare plants that are like one of the witching plants that are associated with Jupiter, whose domain you'll usually find within like hyssop and, you know, what's another good Jupiter plant? Galangal and licorice root. And these things that are very like cleansing and purgative, or not purgative, that's the wrong term. Like spiritually purging, not like herbal purgative. Expectorants, there we go. Stuff like that. Whereas henbane actually works on the body by exciting the blood and the heart so much that you go into like a stupor and you start sweating so much and all of these like moist, airy effects start happening to you, which is the sphere of Jupiter, you know, when you're thinking of the different planets, the moon is cold and moist and et cetera, et cetera. Jupiter is warm and moist and that is where it gets like its air association. But those are like the effects that happen to your body. Like you get sexually excited, you start drooling, start sweating. So all of like your like fluids are coming out, like you're literally moist. And you start like breathing really deeply and breathing really heavily because you can't get any oxygen into your lungs. And, you know, it's a very sad poisoning. Like I'm speaking about it like it's like this amazing thing. But it's a poison that works by expansion rather than restriction. Where at like Saturn, you're going to find poisons like hemlock and, you know, aconite and stuff that restrict the nervous system. So you're finding a Saturnian action in its restriction. At the same time, though, sometimes people are going to say that henbane is of Saturn, which I find also accurate in a weird way, because henbane does have a lot of those like Saturnian qualities, like small flowers, large leaves, toxic leaves, very large roots, tapers, like all those things. I think that like physiognomy wise, like henbane is very Saturnian, but in effect, it is very, very, very Jupiter. And the reason I like it so much is because not only is it like a euphoric where you can like enter into like deeper trance states and stuff, but it also brings rain. It stops rain. You know, it grants you power over beasts. You can make owl rounds out of the root because they actually grow faster and also bigger than mandrakes. You know, you can smoke it. Like you can treat it like tobacco and smoke it and like obtain like prophetic visions. I make a tincture out of the flowers that I actually smell. That is like really good to get into like a diviner's trance, which is like a very light trance that I'm sure you know about. So it's just such a versatile plant. And to me, it's the only witching ally that has really, really like proven to want to work with me. Like I've tried growing belladonna, never happened. You know, aconite I really like as well, but I work with it as like the foam of Cerberus's mouth, like for Hecate stuff. So it's less of a spiritual ally and more of like materia for me. Whereas I find that anyone who will work with henbane is going to notice very, very fast how present and how boisterous its spirit is. And I think that that's actually why some people might not want to work with it as much. I think in the poison path, like there's a very, very large emphasis on Saturnine poisons. You see henbane mentioned just because it appears on flying ointments. But what's interesting is that the Jupiterian action of henbane mitigates the poisonous tendencies of Saturn within the ointment, and that's how you achieve balance. And if we know anything about Kronos and Zeus, you know, yeah. I just find it so fascinating. It's a beautiful, beautiful plant. Very easy to grow as well. It'll grow in a pot. Yeah, it'll just go wherever you go.
I love this. I was trying to see what, I feel kind of embarrassed that I already forgot what plant I just bought seeds for. But I want to say it was henbane. It was either henbane or hemlock. That's why I can't remember.
Oh my god, hemlock? Crazy.
Yeah.
We have so much of it growing in the bogs here.
So jealous. Oh, nope. I was absolutely wrong on all accounts. It was monk's hood.
Hey, aconite. I actually got some aconite seeds recently in a birthday present. So I'm hoping to plant them around. I'm doing like a little ritual of planting my seeds on the winter solstice because, you know, nightshades need like that gestation period.
Yep.
This is the perfect time to plant henbane or aconite or literally any of like your poisonous plants that you want to plant. Nightshades of any sort, mandrake, etc. Like I always do this method instead of the soaking method. So I plant my seeds midwinter. I usually do like a little ritual on the winter solstice and do all those things. But really, like, just like dead of winter, you can sow your seeds and leave the pot outside and then they will germinate in the spring, which I find also very interesting with that like Saturn kind of energy, you know?
Because it is Saturn's time. I actually planted mullein on last year's winter solstice. Well, it wasn't...
Right. The Great Conjunction.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. So mullein is meant to take 2 years. 2 years before it flowers and before you're able to cultivate it. Mine was ready in 8 months. Like,
wow.
It was almost as if that Jupiter influence was like, let's go. Because yeah. I definitely view mullein as more, it's more like moon and Saturn to me.
Yeah, definitely.
And there wasn't very much Jupiter in the plant itself, but that Jupiter influence seemed to have aided in the expansion of the plant's growth.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that makes total sense, especially because, like, we're thinking, like, lunar Saturn, like, obviously, mullein, like, summoning spirits of the dead and aiding apparitions and stuff like that. But when we're talking about, like, biennials, there is this, like, literal cycle of water, like, a tide of water that, like, comes out with the plant as it grows and then retreats into the roots and then comes back again the next spring, which is such a lunar motion. But then replacing that energy, or dominating that energy, really, with, like, Jupiter, like, Pneuma, and making it grow within 8 months is just, like, amazing. Like, so cool.
Yeah, I used a Nina Griffin election for that, so
other people should use her
elections. Yeah. You don't even have to know astrology. You can just ask electional astrologers when to do the magic.
Literally, someone will do the job for you. Support your local metaphysical workers.
Yes. I will add the books that we have been talking about as well as Nina's information in the show notes, along with, of course, every way that one can contact Mohegan.
Thank you.
Yay, well, we're...
Is it a wrap?
Yes. Thank you so much for joining me. This was amazing. This conversation just unearthed so many gold nuggets. I just am so... I love you. Thank you for joining me, Mohegan.
Ah, thank you for having me. I'm so happy to, like, have done this. It was such a beautiful experience, and you have such a, like, a breadth of knowledge and, like, thought, and I'm just so happy to be able to get to pick your brain. Ah, it's been wonderful.
Yay. All right, well, until we meet again.
Absolutely. I'll see you soon.